speaker is Dr. Jill James, and she's professor of pediatrics at the University of Arkansas and the director of the Autism Metabolic Genomics Laboratory at Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. And the title of her talk is not there. I'll let her say it. Okay, Dr. James, thank you.
There it is. Well, thank you, Cindy, and thank you for putting the symposium together for us. It's been extremely informative. So for my part, what I'd like to do is share with you our experience using autism postmortem brain to evaluate oxidative stress and damage in autism. I think we would all agree that it is an interaction between environment and genes underlies the susceptibility and the development of autism in most cases. And the DNA, RNA, protein paradigm with genomics and proteomics has tremendously advanced our understanding of the molecular biology of autism, the potential genes, the potential environmental factors. But what I'd like to do today is take the next step, the products of the DNA, RNA, and protein paradigm to the metabolites that they produce. And actually, the metabolites turn around and become the building blocks for ongoing DNA, RNA, and protein synthesis. So they're very interrelated. Metabolites then create biochemical pathways that then underlie the biochemical processes and the functioning or malfunctioning of the cell or the system. Metabolites, I think, are really at the interface between genes and environment. They reflect both the genetic and epigenetic background of the individual as well as environmental exposures. And in our lab, we take a candidate biochemical pathway approach, and I want to give you some background information on that. So these are the three pathways we study in my lab, very polymorphic, very much influenced by environmental exposures. There are three pathways. The three pathways are, and they're interconnected and interdependent. The first is called the folate cycle, or you may know it as one carbon metabolism. THF stands for tetrahydrofolate, and it's connected through this enzyme methionine synthase to the second pathway, and that's called the methionine cycle or transmethylation. And then further on down to the bottom is transsulfuration, and that leads to the synthesis of glutathione. And I'm showing you glutathione in its two forms. GSH is the active antioxidant form, and GSSG is the disulfide oxidized form. And so we're going to be concentrating on this lower half. But let me put these pathways in a functional context for you, and I think you can see why we think these are such core hubs of function for the cell and the health of the cell. If we take the folate cycle out a bit further, it provides one carbon groups for the synthesis of purines and thymidylate, and these are the bases that make up the DNA. So clearly the folate cycle and folate metabolism is essential for normal error-free DNA synthesis, for cell proliferation, for immune function, for growth, very important for the health and development of the cell and the person. This methyl group on 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate connects pathway 1 and pathway 2. It is transferred to homocysteine to make methionine, and methionine is activated to S-adenosyl methionine, and this is the major methyl donor for a multitude of cellular methylation reactions, including DNA, RNA, protein, phospholipids, neurotransmitters, so very essential part of that pathway. And then if we go down to the bottom, we end up with glutathione synthesis, or we call that redox homeostasis, which is involved with the, well, it creates the reducing environment inside the cell that's essential for all the reactions to occur normally. It is involved with redox signaling for the subtle changes are involved in the decision of a precursor cell to differentiate, proliferate, or die. So clearly you can see that these pathways are core important pathways, and actually my life on one slide right here. I also want to point out that that S-adenosylmethionine is the methyl donor for histone methylation or histone methyltransferase as well as DNA methyltransferase. So that pathway is very much associated with epigenetics. And then at the bottom, and again, this is where we're going to focus the rest of the talk, under chronic or severe conditions, if that ratio of the active reduced glutathione is decreased, that leads to oxidative stress, which can, over long term, lead to oxidative damage. So that's where we're going. I wanted to point out that glutathione synthesis in the brain is a bit different. These are the same three pathways, but the pathway from methionine all the way down to glutathione mainly occurs in the liver. And in the brain, it's incomplete. And the reason is this enzyme that converts cystathionine to cysteine is expressed at very low levels in the brain. And what that means is this pathway stops right here, and the cells cannot complete glutathione synthesis. And it turns out they depend on the liver to supply them with cysteine so that then they can complete glutathione synthesis. So it's very interesting. There's a two-step process there. And let me just briefly show you how that works. Again, the liver is the main producer of glutathione. 80% is released into the plasma. It's broken down. Cysteine is the important amino acid of glutathione. It's oxidized to cystine, which is the disulfide form. And here's where it gets interesting. The cystine crosses the blood-brain barrier, and it can be taken up by astrocytes, but not neurons. That's rather bizarre, but that's the way it is. So the astrocytes then take up the cystine, and that means then that the astrocytes are dependent on the liver. So it goes ahead and finishes up glutathione synthesis and then releases glutathione into the extracellular space, broken down again, and now neurons can take up the cysteine, the reduced form, which is very interesting, a different transporter, and they can complete glutathione synthesis. So it's interesting then that the neurons are dependent on the astrocytes are dependent on the liver. So this is another maybe less appreciated protective role of astrocytes, which is to supply them with the cysteine to complete their glutathione synthesis. So the downside of that is that if the astrocytes have a redox problem or glutathione redox problem, the neurons are in big trouble. Another interesting aside is that the same relationship between astrocytes and neurons is present between macrophages and T cells. T cells can't take up cystine, so they can't complete glutathione synthesis either. So in this case, the macrophages release the glutathione, break it down to cysteine, and now the T cells can take it up. Interesting parallel, I think. So this is what glutathione looks like. It's a tripeptide, and it's actually the cysteine, which is the rate-limiting amino acid, is the active component. And it's this sulfhydryl group donating that hydrogen to quench free radicals, either directly, enzymatically, or non-enzymatically, is how glutathione acts as the major intracellular antioxidant. It's also, glutathione is also the major mechanism for detoxification. That SH group on cysteine is a magnet for heavy metals. And once it's bound, the cell is protected in this conjugate. There's a huge family of enzymes called glutathione S transferases, GSTs, and they enzymatically create that conjugate to protect the cell. And then it is metabolized down and excreted. So this is how it works as detoxification. And this is just diagrammatically to show you that when this ratio is high, and it needs to have a several-fold increase of the active to the oxidized inactive form, when there is a toxic insult, there's a blip, but it doesn't quite reach the toxic threshold. Whereas if the glutathione ratio is decreased and what we call a limited reserve or fragile homeostasis, that same toxic insult can cross the toxic threshold and lead to oxidative damage. So by way of background, in previous work over the last several years, we have found a decrease in this GSH-GSSG redox capacity or antioxidant capacity or detoxification capacity. We've seen it in three independent case control cohorts in plasma. We've seen it in lymphoblastoid cell lines, case control, and most recently in primary immune cells. And this was our publication last year in JAD, and we showed that inside the cell, in the primary cells, it was associated with markers of protein and DNA damage. So the goal of the study I'm going to be showing you today was, well, let's look at the target organ. We need to know, is we're seeing it in plasma, in the cells, and cell lines, is it there in the brain? And so this is how we got into the postmortem brain business here. And we wanted to look at whether we could even see a difference in redox status and whether we could also see, as we had in the periphery, markers of protein and DNA oxidative damage. And we also were interested in looking at more functional indicators of inflammation and mitochondrial dysfunction. And we have a marker for superoxide production, which I will explain. This is our paper. It's under final review at Translational Psychiatry. Actually, the comments were quite minor, so we have high hopes this will be published soon. This is the work of Shannon Rose. She's my pre-doctoral student. I'm going to have to leave immediately after. She's graduating tomorrow, and so I need to get home to be there to hood her. So we hypothesized then in the study that we'd see this low redox status and that it would be associated with markers of protein oxidative damage, and we look at 3-nitrotyrosine for that. We looked at DNA oxidative damage, and we look at 8-oxydeoxyguanosine, and we wanted to see if we could see any signs of mitochondrial dysfunction, because that is most likely the most likely source of free radicals, and we're looking for excessive superoxide production, which is where mitochondria is where superoxide is generated, and also chronic inflammation, and for that we look at 3-chlorotyrosine. Okay, so our samples, we got our samples from the ATP, the Autism Tissue Program, and also University of Maryland, NICHD. We ended up with 15 autism and 15 cases and 15 control frozen tissue blocks, and we made homogenates. And this is actually a pretty high number relative to other postmortem brain studies. We're very lucky to get 15 each. We looked in the cerebellum, and then we also looked in BA22 and the superior temporal gyrus, and we had 12 case and 12 control blocks for that. Shannon chose the case and control blocks in pairs, given information in the repository, and this actually was a heroic undertaking, but I think critical for postmortem brain studies. She matched as closely as humanly possible across 5 variables: gender, race, PMI, age, and cause of death. And as a result, when we did our analysis, between case and control, there were no significant differences in age, gender, race, or PMI. The average age was 18, and the 18 years, and the average PMI for this study was 19 hours. And this is an example of Shannon's spreadsheet, and you can see race and sex were pretty easy to match, but then if you looked at cause of death, which again, to find identical is very rare, but we tried to match as best as possible, but you might be able to match there, but then she'd have to find a match that would also match the age and the PMI. So again, it was a very painstaking procedure, but I think critical for when you're doing a case control analysis like this. The other point I wanted to make was that When we talk about the pathology here in postmortem brain, we can talk about pathophysiology, but we cannot talk about pathogenesis. And that's because I think the youngest age, maybe 2 or 4, very rare, and our average age was 18. So what we see really cannot be extrapolated to developmental changes directly because we don't know. So I just wanted to be sure that was clear. We chose to look in the cerebellum because, as you know, there are many studies have shown a reduction in Purkinje cell numbers. There have been dysregulation of GABA and glutamatergic systems, also evidence of activated microglia and cytokines and indications of oxidative stress. And very interesting, our recent reviews have emphasized that localized cerebellar infarcts in individuals are associated with deficits in attention, cognition, affective behavior, and expressive language, which kind of suggests that maybe we need to not dismiss the cerebellum in terms of core symptoms of autism. We also looked at BA22 in the superior temporal gyrus. It's a center for auditory processing and Wernicke's area in speech processing. There's been evidence of glial cell proliferation and reduced neuronal density and an increase in an oxidative damage marker, lipofuscin. So with that prolonged prologue, and I hope we'll make the data have more meaning for you, we're now at the data. So here we have the closed circles are controls and the open circles are cases. We're looking at the active glutathione and the oxidized glutathione. And what we found was in both cerebellum and in BA22, there was a decrease in glutathione levels compared to controls and a slight increase in the oxidized form GSSG. If we look at the ratio then, clearly the in cerebellum we're seeing a very significant decrease in this ratio that reflects the redox capacity, the antioxidant, the detoxification capacity in cases in cerebellum and also in BA22. And what's particularly striking to me is the lack of variation here. That's really a cluster, and I'm not quite sure why it's so tight, other than maybe the matching. Anyway, this is very nice to see. So for the protein and DNA damage, we use 3-nitrotyrosine, and this is a well-established marker of the nitrosylation of tyrosines on protein. It's a marker of oxidative protein damage. 3-chlorotyrosine is interesting. It is known to be a marker of inflammation, and it's not often used. And has, I don't think, 3-chlorotyrosine has been seen in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's as well. But it's a marker of activated immune cells, and it's due to the release of hypochlorous acid, which is produced by myeloperoxidase in activated immune cells. So we measured 3-chlorotyrosine, and then 8-oxyDG is an adduct on DNA that is associated with G to T transversion mutations. So those were our endpoints. And here's the results for those. Again, an increase in nitrotyrosine protein damage, oxidative damage, in both BA22 and cerebellum. Chlorotyrosine, the marker of inflammation, increased in both, more so in the cerebellum than the BA22. So again, this is going in the same direction, which I think is comforting. Here we're looking at the 8-oxyDG. Now this is in DNA, seeing a insignificant increase in the cerebellum and also in BA22. And this again was comforting because this is the this is a nice correlation that you would expect. And so that again strengthens, I think, across both cases and controls. But what you see is the low redox capacity is associated with higher oxidative damage, DNA oxidative damage. And as GSH increases, the damage is decreased. And you can see this clustering of the autism at one end. Well, this is an interesting indicator as well, and it's been shown to be increased in schizophrenia and Alzheimer's as well. And aconitase is an enzyme in the TCA cycle, and it's redox sensitive because there is an iron sulfur cluster at the active site. And when superoxide, which is generated or released there from the electron transport chain, hits that iron sulfur cluster, it inactivates the enzyme. So when you see a decrease in activity, it is a reflection of mitochondrial dysfunction, or at least a superoxide production that's not being buffered. And this is how that works. Here is aconitase in the TCA cycle, and here's the iron sulfur cluster. So when superoxide hits it, what happens is one of the irons is knocked off. It reacts with hydrogen peroxide by Fenton chemistry, producing a more damaging hydroxyl ion, and together chronically they can decrease the redox antioxidant capacity. These are our results for aconitase then. A decrease in the cerebellum, quite significant. Not significant in BA22, although there was a trend. I think the p-value was 0.1. And again, these correlations across the group are comforting to me because they're in the direction we would expect, that aconitase activity is low when the redox capacity is low and increases with when the redox capacity is improved. And again, you see the clustering more so in cerebellum than BA22. So this is how we put it all together, theoretically. We think there could be, well, that there are bidirectional arrows between a low antioxidant capacity, mitochondrial dysfunction, hydroxyl iron formation, and inflammation. So theoretically, this can create a self-sustaining or self-amplifying vicious cycle. Here's where our endpoints come in. Superoxide will inactivate aconitase. SOD creates H2O2, which can react with iron to make the hydroxyl iron, or myeloperoxidase to create the 3-chlorotyrosine, and here's the peroxynitrite with 3-nitrotyrosine and the 8-oxyguanine. I think any one of these markers independently would be interesting, but to me, I think it's impressive that they all, in different ways, are saying the same thing, that there is a more oxidizing, damaging environment in autism brain. Okay, so just to summarize then, this again is one of the largest studies to look at oxidative stress and damage. And the decrease in aconitase implicates the mitochondria as a potential source and target in the brain. The chlorotyrosine is the first indication that there may be elevated myeloperoxidase activity. And again, it's an established marker of inflammation, has been shown to be increased in schizophrenia and Alzheimer's. And I think this is the first indication in autism, and supports other studies of increased inflammation. Again, it was good that comforting that the low antioxidant potential was associated with a decrease in aconitase activity, and that the protein oxidative and DNA oxidative damage were associated also with a decrease in this redox or antioxidant detoxification capacity. So we conclude then that the decrease in this redox potential that we saw in the periphery is also in the brain, and it suggests that a pro-oxidant microenvironment in these individuals may be pervasive and systemic. And the fact that we're seeing, well, ideally we would like to have brain and plasma from one individual, but that's clearly not possible. But because we are seeing these parallel changes, I think for these markers at least, that the peripheral markers are a good surrogate for what may be going on in the brain. But I have to point out that we're doing another study looking at epigenetics, case control, same regions, and the peripheral markers do not correlate with what we see in the brain. We see in lymphocytes, we see a global hypomethylation, DNA hypomethylation, loss of methyl groups, whereas in the brain, we see the opposite. We see hypermethylation. So at least, so in that case, at least in our hands, the peripheral markers are not a good marker, but it would seem that these biochemical footprints really that we can measure and quantify are there peripherally as well as in the brain. And that these markers may have some functional consequence in terms of chronic inflammatory response, increased superoxide production, which implicates the mitochondria, and oxidative damage, protein and DNA damage. So how do we get from epidemiology to mechanism? Well, I think we all agree that genes are involved, but there are multiple variable additive genes, as well as multiple additive variable environmental factors. And they're probably different ones in different kids, and probably underlies a lot of the heterogeneity. And it's a huge challenge. We think they're both necessary, but in most cases not independently sufficient. But we would like to suggest that a metabolic footprint, a metabolic endophenotype that is stable, such as the GSH-GSSG ratio, could lead us closer to mechanism. And in our case, it would be redox imbalance or oxidative stress that might get us closer to understanding the behavior. And most importantly, it's treatable. And I was very happy last year to see Antonio Hardin's presentation, where he has done double-blind placebo-controlled study of N-acetylcysteine in children with autism. And that study was just published a few months ago in Biological Psychiatry. And he showed that behavioral endpoints of irritability, several, were improved with N-acetylcysteine treatment. We have a double-blind placebo-controlled study in progress. Again, I know we've shown in an open-label trial that we can fix that glutathione ratio. The big question is, parents want to know, is does correcting that affect behavior? I'm quite sure their health, their immune system is better, but whether or not the behavior has anything to do with this is certainly an open question. And I did want to just make the point that there are bidirectional arrows between the gut, the brain, and the immune system. And so when we're looking in the brain for biochemical changes, we really don't know whether it's direct or indirect or where the origin is. So finally, this is our working hypothesis that the inability to maintain this redox status and control oxidative stress may contribute to the development of neurologic, immunologic, and GI dysfunction that occurs with autism. And then I always like to end with this slide. This is every metabolic pathway in the cell, and we know that one very well, and there's a whole lot out there that we don't know yet. So let me just show you the acknowledgments of people in the lab, our coordinators, and our funding. And this is Shannon, who graduates tomorrow, and I'll have to go to the airport now. So thank you very much.
Thank you.